Well, thank you, Trevor Oliver, and to Tom Danheiser, and most importantly to Bob Fukuda, who's the market director for engineering at Clear Channel Chicago, for getting me up on the air tonight on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett with a face for radio and a voice for print. I'll tell you this right off the bat. I did not want to miss this show tonight, not just because this is the kind of show I would love to listen to, but because it's just so much fun to do. And even though I'm on the road in Chicago, we were able to pull it together to get a studio on so that we didn't have to miss this one. And it's going to be so interesting to get this update from Galen Cook. Now, you might remember Galen Cook has been on with us a couple of times now, and together we're kind of tracking down the true identity of D.B. Cooper using the massive resources of Coast to Coast AM and Galen Cook, who is a former investigator, now a lawyer in Washington State. We started the show back in Thanksgiving weekend with a visit with Galen Cook on the weekend anniversary of the successful skyjacking of D.B. Cooper. And then we got a phone call from a family who said, you know what, that's dad. Galen Cook, who had already had a suspect that he liked a lot, even changed, had a 180, and was seriously looking at this particular suspect being offered by his family, because the man had passed and he had told individual members of his family that he was, in fact, D.B. Cooper, and showed them evidence to that effect. And the pictures say a lot. In fact, we'll get more on that coming up this hour on the website. I'll tell you about that in a few minutes. But we're going to put something up on the website at coasttocoastam.com, a new photo where you can really see the similarities between the man whom the FBI identified as D.B. Cooper and this man who as of now shall remain nameless. But we'll talk more about that with Galen Cook and what more he's been able to figure out on the story. Plus, coming up a little bit later on in the show, Peter von Puttkamer. He is the producer of at Griffin Productions. They do a lot of documentaries. He's been on the road investigating everything from Bigfoot to giant tarantulas to being in, you know, these amazing caves to hunted circumstances to where people are doing the most bizarre things. And he's also been involved in these native rituals and every possible activity out there on the fringe. He's not only seen it, but he's participated in it. And we'll tell you more about his latest monster hunting expeditions coming up on Coast to Coast AM. Looking forward to that. But let's get started with some amazing crypto news. I think the most incredible story of this week, and it all sounds so familiar. Plus, the story of the manual which instructs firefighters on how to deal with a UFO invasion. Maybe you saw that tonight on the website. We'll tell you more about it in crypto news next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. Again, Galen Cook with an important update coming up on the D.B. Cooper story, and I'm really loving where this is going. Wouldn't it be cool if we were able to break this story on Coast to Coast and finally solve the mystery of who was D.B. Cooper? We'll bring you up to speed on that coming up a little bit later on. First, in crypto news for tonight. By the way, can you hear me okay? Can you hear the thumping of the hip-hop music in the background? No one can hear that. I'm so glad. I'm doing this broadcast from a studio which is right next door to a late night hip hop station, which has a live DJ in the studio, and he's doing the whole McMaster thing with the discs flying. He's got two vinyl turntables going, and it's cool to watch. But he's really cranking the music up, and he's dancing, and there's all these people dancing about literally about 8 feet from me, but it's separated by a wall and soundproof glass. I can feel the floor underneath me going thump, 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 thump. And I can even hear it when I take off my headphones, but apparently it's not coming through the processing. So we're in good shape. But if you were sitting there next to me, I swear it'd be like being next to an apartment filled with a bunch of college kids going ape on some band I've never heard of that's already won 9 Grammys. You know how that works. All right, so as far as I'm concerned, the weirdest news story of this week in crypto news the reports that the Secret Service waived their protection of Barack Obama in Dallas. Now, that's the that was the claim made by a police officer who went on the record to say he was told to stop screening people and let them come on in. Had you heard this update, though, that the U.S. Secret Service Friday denied reports that security measures at this Obama rally in Texas were relaxed or deviated from established plans? Secret Service spokesman Eric Zarin said that there was no order from the Secret Service to stop screening people going to the Obama rally Wednesday at the Dallas Reunion Arena. He said that the event's security plans did not involve having each participant pass through a magnometer, as may be the case with other events. So he's saying the fact that a police officer said that they were told to no longer put people through the metal detectors isn't unusual, because he said there was no rule that said that they all had to go through the metal detectors. Anyway, they go on to say, the Secret Service, any allegations to the fact that we had suspended screening or deviated from the original security plan would be entirely inaccurate. But how familiar does that sound, huh? The Secret Service denies telling the Dallas police to stand down on its security of a potential, you know, Kennedy-like president, some guy like that. I don't know. And then the story, the sad story of the police officer who was killed on the motorcycle. The only way this story could get weirder is if that police officer's last name had been Tippett. From fizorg.com, now it is possible to see a movie of an electron. The movie shows how an electron rides on a light wave after just having been pulled away from an atom. This is the first time an electron has ever been filmed, and the results are presented in the latest issue of Physical Review Letters. As important as the electron is, and this is the first time it's appearing on film, makes you wonder, doesn't it? How is it that an electron is just getting on the screen and Pauly Shore has already made all those movies? It just doesn't seem right. And this new movie with the electron already made more money than Paris Hilton's The Hottie and the Naughty. Sorry. Did you hear about that movie? That Paris Hilton's movie, The Hottie and the Naughty, and its opening weekend, opening in like 2,000 theaters, made $9,000 or something. Some amazingly low amount. I'm sure they didn't cover that in Physical Review Letters. That's where this story is from. We've linked it up at the website, coasttocoastam.com. Physical Review Letters. Sounds like Penthouse Forum for scientists, doesn't it? Online tonight at the Daily Mail, also at the website, the story of Mavis Price. She's the 60-year-old grandmother who seems to have a freakishly high level of static electricity coursing through her veins. She estimates she has destroyed 15 tea kettles in the last few years. Housework is a problem. 20 irons and 10 vacuum cleaners biting the dust after falling foul of her apparently supercharged touch. She's like Magneto without the helmet, I assume. Maybe she's got a helmet, too. And her friends and family are often left with hair standing on end after touching her. I should use that excuse. My wife asked me to vacuum. I should say, I'm sorry, I blow up vacuum cleaners. She also can't have a computer in her house, though, because they go berserk at the touch of her hand. You can find out more on that story online. I hope this woman is never allowed to wear corduroy pants. For God's sake, she could blow up half of England. And let's keep this statically charged grandmother out of Arizona, which is close to becoming the Persian Gulf of solar energy, according to CNN. A Spanish company is planning to take 3 square miles of desert southwest of Phoenix and turn them into one of the largest solar power plants in the world. The company, which has plants in Spain, Northern Africa, and other parts of the U.S., could begin construction as early as next year on this small, dusty town 50 miles southwest of Phoenix. The company said Thursday it could be online with solar energy by 2011. It's a $1 billion power plant. But again, like that, CNN describes it as the Persian Gulf of solar energy right here in the United States. Good thing that President Bush is leaving office, or we might end up having invaded ourselves somehow before it was over. Sorry. And then speaking of Phoenix, The 600-page guide may lend credibility to UFO believers. It's in a story from a Phoenix TV station. You can find it at coasttocoastam.com. The Fire Officer's Guide to Disaster Control can apparently be found in firehouses across the U.S., though. It covers everything from fire and flood response to aviation disasters. Chapter 13 of the book has an unusual twist titled Enemy Attack and UFO Potential. It outlines what could happen in the event of a UFO crash. The authors of the book, retired firefighters, write in part, it would be remiss not to give some part to the role fire departments might play in the event of the unexpected arrival of UFOs in their communities. In a less optimistic scenario, you may have engine trouble upon approaching the scene. Radio contact could be lost with your dispatcher. If at night your headlights could go out, the city could be blacked out, and your portable generators may malfunction when you attempt to use them for fans and portable lights. For the sake of the first responders, I hope Chapter 14 of this manual is how not to get vaporized by their alien death rays. Because that always seems to happen in those movies. Remember, they like turn green, they glow, and then they're gone. And if you take a look online, I'll try and get the blog up a little bit later on this hour, too. Our guest is ready. Galen Cook is standing by with another breaking story. Well, at least of sorts, anyway. It's not the breaking story that we want, though, Galen, yet. The one where we take it to the FBI and we've proved beyond a shadow of a doubt that we know who D.B. Cooper is. But we're getting closer, aren't we?
Absolutely. By the way, pleasure to be back on your show, Ian.
I love having you on. I cannot wait to do this, because I think there is something about this story that seems so plausible. But you are our investigator in the field on this, Galen, so let's start from the beginning. You're talking about somebody that you like as being your prime suspect for D.B. Cooper. Then you were contacted by this family. Is the family still remaining nameless?
At this time, yes, and I want to compliment them. There's basically the widow and then three sons. The three sons are not related to the widow. The widow was a wife that came down the line later. But
the stepmom.
That's correct. But they've been coordinating with me, and we're doing this slowly and methodically. The family does not have an agenda, but they would like to know the truth, and that's why we're working steadily on this thing. And by the way, I don't know if you put it up on the website yet, but the latest evidence that I gave you is the exact same evidence I gave the FBI. So you and your listeners have the same thing the FBI has right now on this suspect.
All right. So we have a photo, which is coming up in a few minutes, and that'll go up at coasttocoastam.com. Mm-hmm. And this is a new photo that also looks remarkably like the photo of the drawing made by the FBI's sketch artist.
That's correct. Actually, there's about three or four, and I can't tell you which exactly. It's either three or four artist renderings that were produced in 1971 and 1972 of the suspect D.B. Cooper. And they were taken from actual eyewitnesses on the flight 305 on November 24th, 1971. They were probably taken from two of the flight attendants and the gentleman who was seated directly across the aisle from D.B. Cooper. So that they all look pretty much the same, but as everyone has a little different interpretation of what they remember seeing, they might vary a little bit, but they're all pretty close.
Now, let's go back before we go forward. The last time you were on, we had a photo sent by the family, and then we had the sketch by the FBI, and then we had somebody who was very kind, their name escapes me. I don't know that I even kept it, who did a composite for us of those two things to show just how close they were. And we'll put that up, too, coming up in just a few minutes. And so you can see again just how if we just morphed the FBI sketch just ever so slightly, we have almost a dead ringer for the FBI sketch.
You have some ingenious listeners out there, and
aren't they talented?
Your audience is the greatest. I got to tell you, Ian, this what he did really brings out the essence of the D.B. Cooper lookalike.
All right, so we'll have that coming up in a few minutes. And then the new photograph. Now, but the last time you were on with us, we were talking about trying to find some of the other witnesses. One in particular was a flight attendant who had moved away, had changed her name, had gotten married. And had you had any luck hearing from anybody who knew who any of the other witnesses were?
Yes, I have. I have talked with one of the crew. There were six crew members from Northwest Airlines that night, three pilots and three flight attendants. I know where one flight attendant is, and I sent her the same picture that has been up on the web for about 6 weeks. She has not returned my calls yet. She has not returned the letter and the picture. So I don't know if she even received it, but she's not the principal witness I'm looking for. The one I'm looking for is Tina Mucklow. Now, I know a little something more about Tina, and I got that from another private investigator. Tina probably doesn't go by the name Mucklow anymore. She goes by Tina Larson. And something very odd I learned just a couple days ago. Tina has been hard to find, and she doesn't want to talk much about the case. Now, remember, this is a 37-year-old cold case, and the FBI is actively trying to wrap this case up. They've been on the news a lot in the last 4 or 5 months, as you well know. Turns out that Tina's brother-in-law is an FBI agent. So that might be part of the reason we're not having any luck locating Tina. And that's been confirmed to me by two different sources. Tina's brother-in-law was an FBI agent.
Was, but that might be why the FBI is keeping her under wraps?
I wish I could answer that question. I don't know. Tina has had an interesting life since D.B. Cooper. She no longer works for the airline. She became a nun, and she was in a monastery down there in southern Oregon for a number of years. Quit that and moved down to San Diego. And we've lost track of her movement since then. Now, another investigator who I've been coordinating with on this case, and he's out of New York City, he's looking for Tina, too, but we're not having any luck. Tina is the flight attendant who spent the most time on the plane with D.B. Cooper.
Okay. Now, let's just go over that for a second. We're looking for a former flight attendant, former nun, whose brother used to be in the FBI, and she lives in the San Diego area. How many of those could there actually be?
Well, I don't think she's in the San Diego area anymore, but
okay.
But she keeps to herself. Now, what's interesting is I looked on the internet here a few weeks ago, and they actually have an old CBS black and white news clip. It's a Walter Cronkite clip that came out the night after the D.B. Cooper event. That would have been probably November 25th on 1971. And the newscaster in Reno, Nevada, tried to get an interview with Tina Mucklow, but Tina didn't want to say much. Well, she's still not saying much, and it's 37 years later. I want her to look at this black and white photo of my suspect, and I want to see if this jogs her memory and says, yeah, that's either the guy or it's not the guy.
Right. I think that's very key. Now, she might, of course, and this is sometime later, so it would be helpful maybe if in the classic police style we put 4 or 5 similar-looking photographs up there, too, if we can, and see whether or not she might be able to, if we ever had the opportunity. It would only help to bolster the case if out of those 4 or 5 she picked this guy who we'll call what? Main suspect? Suspect number one? What do we want to call him for the rest of the conversation?
Well, we'll just call him the suspect.
The right suspect.
Yeah.
Okay. So so that would be interesting, too, because that would only, sure. You know, after all these years, that would really help if she went, no, that's it. But, all right, so let's, again, we're looking for Tina, former nun, former flight attendant, and we'll talk more about this here in just a second, because we're just about to put up. We'll hit the send button or enter or whatever we got to do here. We'll put up all the photographs we talked about at coasttocoastam.com so that everybody can see them for themselves. And then we'll continue this conversation coming up with Galen Cook. And you know what? We'll probably hold on till after a little bit into the next hour, too, if that's all right, Galen, so we can get some phone calls in for you. But we'll give you the latest that we know, all of the new things we've heard from the family. And we'll go over the story that you're going to want to hear as we continue to try to track down the real D.B. Cooper. And you're hearing it live on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. All right, so it's Coast to Coast AM with Ian Punnett, and we're in our first hour here. I'm just about to check the website at coasttocoastam.com. If it's not up yet, it will be very shortly. The photographs we were just talking about, new evidence from the family of the man we're calling the prime suspect in the D.B. Cooper successful skyjacking. We'll go over a little bit of the history again. I want to talk about the DNA evidence and find out what more Galen Cook, who's an investigator turned attorney in Washington State, has been able to find out since he was last on the air with us. And you'll see another photograph of the man, including the composite drawing that was done of the original sketch by the FBI, morphed slightly by a listener to include the physical features of the man who is the prime suspect we're talking about tonight on coasttocoastam.com. If not now, then shortly. And more on this conversation coming up on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. Well, I love the work that Galen Cook is doing with us here on this D.B. Cooper story, which we've been a part of. And this is really cool, the new stuff. And thank you to Sean for getting it up on the website, too, at coasttocoastam.com. You go in there right now and you see what we're talking about. Another photograph provided by the family of the person we're calling our prime suspect. And in this new photograph, we're seeing all sorts of things. We can look at this at the headshot. If we just isolated the face of the suspect and looked at that with the original FBI composite drawing, we really see even there kind of a greater similarity maybe than even in the other shot, particularly in the chin and in the cheeks, where it's really eerily like the FBI drawing in this new photograph. Don't you think, Galen?
Yeah, it certainly is, Ian. I've got the photo right in front of me. Now, the first photo was taken in 1971, and this shows the suspect in his military fatigues. And
right.
He was active Army in that time. The new photo that just went up on your site moments ago shows him in his dress uniform. And what it doesn't show, I cropped the picture, what it doesn't show is the Brigadier General pinning an award on his left shirt pocket. And the award he's being given is the MSM, or the Meritorious Service Medal. And I believe just days after he got this medal, he retired permanently from the military. And this picture right here was taken in early August of 1973 at Fort Lewis, Washington. Fort Lewis is a Army command post located about 35 miles south of SeaTac Airport, and that's, of course, where the famous D.B. Cooper skyjacking took place.
And where we think he was originally trying to get to, because he wanted, when the plane took off, he wanted the back stairs to be lowered already on takeoff so that he could jump out right away.
Well, that's my theory and the theory of others. I don't think he necessarily wanted to or planned on dropping right in on his barracks. But
no, but as opposed to, I mean, to be closer, because it saves him a walk and saves him a hitchhike or however he thought he was going to get back to the base.
He wanted to jump out in territory he at least had some familiarity with. Now, what I want your listeners and viewers to concentrate on is something very important on this picture, and that's the reason I put the picture up. It's not so much because of the headshot. We've seen the headshot. And by the way, you mentioned something that's important on this, and that's the chin. You notice the chin has gotten a little thicker in this 1973 photo from as compared to the 1971 photo. And that's something I've been looking at. In fact, I have other pictures of this suspect in age progression, and I'll share those with you at a later date. But he definitely grew a little bit of a chin.
Well, I can see where the jowls are coming down a little bit as he's gotten older, but it's I want to point out, I know this sounds like we're, you know, maybe microanalyzing this, but I think it's really interesting. If you look at the FBI composite drawing, you see how prominent the chin is on the drawing, right?
Yeah.
And then you see the shading that they gave the suspect's face, which, you know, was probably just to highlight his gauntness or to reflect, you know, the light that they thought. But it also seems to imply a kind of swarthiness in his original face. Now, we don't know until we talk to the people who were standing there who were telling the FBI sketch artist what was significant about that shading on the side of his face. But it seems to imply a kind of swarthy aspect of his complexion, because that type of that shading isn't as dark on other parts of his face. And then you look at the new photograph that you put up and you see that chin line follows almost the exact outline that the original FBI sketch does.
It's a terrific observation you're making, Ian, and it's also pertinent to this case. There's something about the composite drawings of D.B. Cooper that around the chin and the neckline that are a little mysterious. And if you look at the photos that I've received from the family members, you'll notice that there is something about the chin. In fact, I talked with the widow, and she's mentioned this a few times too. The hairline is almost perfect to a T. The ears are absolutely right perfect. On the money.
Exactly.
The age lines below his nose, even around his lips, are, I'd say, just about perfect. One area that I've always had a little bit of trouble with are his eyebrows. D.B. Cooper, without the sunglasses, at least in the artist rendition, shows a little bit thinner eyebrows, where my suspect's eyebrows are a little thicker and not quite as long, but I don't think that's as significant as other features.
Because he could have gone to, I mean, literally, before the sketch was done, before he did the jump, he could have been at a barber, and my barber thins out my eyebrows every time I go in. So, I mean, that's not that unusual. I mean, that's not a characteristic that's kind of hard and fast, obviously.
That's right. Now, what I want your listeners and viewers to look at is the second picture or the second photo, and I want them to look above the left pocket, and you'll notice the award ribbons. There's three rows of them. And then I want them to look at the little insignia. It's actually a medal, and it's located directly above the ribbons. Now, I had to use a magnifying glass to see this, but when I was going through some of the material that the family had forwarded on to me, I had to use a magnifying glass. And this thing, when it appeared in the magnifying glass, I'll tell you, I just about did a backflip. What it is it's a little medallion that's pinned above the ribbons, and it's the jump wings. Now, the let me tell you what it depicts, because some people don't have magnifying glasses handy.
Sure.
It's an open canopy parachute with wings going from the top of the canopy down to the lower end of the parachute. I call them wings. Some people said they actually look more like wreaths, but I've talked to people who both are active and retired in the U.S. Army, and they said those are actually called jump wings. Now, back in the 60s and the 70s, anyone who had paratrooper training and a certain number of jumps under their belt was awarded this particular jump wing. So in fact, this suspect we have had parachute experience.
Now this is important, because we talked about the whole high altitude, low opening thing last time, and I thought this was significant that there was no particular halo uniform insignia at the time that this photograph was taken.
That's correct. I want to make sure this is very clear. I had to talk with some people who were in the military, and they told me that the halo looks a little bit like the jump wings, except there's a star above the open canopy. And the halo medal wasn't actually developed until either the late 80s or the 90s. There were halo jumpers, but they didn't have a halo insignia in the 60s and 70s. And from talking with several of the sons of this suspect, they remember quite distinctly their father training doing night halo jumps in the military.
Now, this is... they remember him when he was doing the jumps, or that he talked about it?
Nope. I talked with the oldest son, who's now in his mid to latter 50s, and he said when he was a kid, probably in 7th or 8th grade, he remembered his dad having to go out on night maneuvers, and they were living in California at the time, and they were doing night halo jumps. He distinctly remembers that.
Now, do we know, we have it confirmed yet that this particular suspect was at the base near Seattle at the time of the successful skyjacking of that flight?
It's a good question, and it goes directly to the heart of the case, Ian. This is what I've been able to find. This suspect, I'm actually looking at a good part of his military record right now. Through the Freedom of Information Act, I requested the DD-214 form, which is the discharge papers that give pretty much the entire military history of a person. This suspect joined the military at age 16 in 1946, and he started out in the Air Force. He later took an honorable discharge from, back then it was called the Army Air Force. Then he joined the Marines in 1955, and he served in the Marines until, I'm looking at the record here, he was actually received an honorable discharge from the U.S. Marine Corps in 1964. And then that same year, he joined the United States Army. So he served in three different branches of the military.
I'll be darned.
Yeah. And then, now, his record is nebulous from 1965 to 1967. That's why I'm still pursuing this, because I can't find accurate information to show what he did during those years. However, in 1968, he was in Fort Ord with the Army. And he received several letters of commendation, too, from the military. So he served honorably. Now, to get to the date that we need, which is 1971. In 1970, he took an honorable discharge from the U.S. Army. Now, get this. In 1971, he became an ROTC instructor. And I'm not going to say where right now, but he became an ROTC instructor with the U.S. Army, and he served as an ROTC instructor for 2 years. For those people that don't know what that is, that's Reserve Officers Training Corps. So he was basically teaching at a major college, which has an Army ROTC unit, and that's what he did. So in 1971, which is the critical year, he was an ROTC instructor, and I'm not going to say whether he was in Washington State or not, but the 1973 photo, which is up on the web now, that shows him receiving his last award, was taken at Fort Lewis, Washington.
You're going to have to pardon me here, but I need to know why you're leaving that specifically blank when seemingly this is what it would hang on.
Yeah, I understand, but if I give you the name of the college where he was teaching at, it could be checked quickly, I think, and the name could be determined. And I still have a duty to protect the name for the family's interest. So I'm doing the best I can. I'd love to give the name, but I told the family I wouldn't until the FBI had a chance to look at this evidence and make a decision whether or not this was the guy or was not.
Okay, but why can't you tell us whether or not he was in the Seattle area?
Well, I'll tell you what. I'll tell you this. He was not in the Seattle area.
Okay.
Yeah. In fact, I'll tell you what. He was in Utah. He was in Utah. He was teaching. He was an ROTC Army instructor in Utah. But
on the night of the jump, he was assigned to some ROTC location in Utah.
This is where it gets dicey. The youngest son told me that his father had already split up with his mother at that time. However, the son and the mother were living in Utah. The father, this is the suspect now, was not living with them. But you got to remember, this DB Cooper jump took place on Thanksgiving Eve, and it's very possible that he had made a trip up to Washington State, more specifically the Seattle area, and had business up there. And the reason he had business up there is because this particular ROTC sponsored our unit, or this ROTC college, was under the jurisdiction of Fort Lewis. So he would have business in Fort Lewis, Washington. Fort Lewis is sure. is the regional headquarters for all the Western ROTC colleges.
So the plot thickens.
You start putting it together, and it does fit. It's now what he was doing up there on Thanksgiving, I don't know, but the son did tell me this, that the father at that time had already split up with the mom and wasn't living at home. So if you put yourself into this mindset where you're going to go back and look at what would someone be doing the night before Thanksgiving, and then why didn't someone show up to the dinner table on Thanksgiving? Well, in this case, it wouldn't matter because the father was already living on his own.
Well, and let's go back too a little bit. If he had conceived of this plan, right, prior to Thanksgiving, prior to the family breaking up, he might, you know, if this is what he did, if the prime suspect is D.B. Cooper, you don't deviate from the plan and now change it and try to transpose this very successful plan that you've got all worked out to be happening in Utah. Maybe you just stay with plan A. You know, you've got a buddy that you're gonna stay with at the fort. You could, you know, you could rack up with a friend who's got a place there, and he's none the wiser. And you've got some sort of reason to be there, and you just go back to plan A, and then you show up days later back at the later on the weekend or something like that and visit the kids on Thanksgiving weekend and get your life started up all over again.
He had familiarity with the Seattle area. Now, I'm going to open up the door to something. It's highly speculative, but it's eerie. And here's what happened about 6 months after the D.B. Cooper jump. There was a guy named Richard Floyd McCoy who did the same exact thing with a United Airlines flight, Denver to Los Angeles. And he hijacked a 727, and he collected $500,000 and some parachutes and jumped out. And it took the FBI about 3 days, but they did nail him. Well, this guy was from Utah, and he was also in the military. He was in the Army, and he was also a paratrooper. And you start looking at these things, and you wonder, now, this is rather interesting. We got a couple guys here who were down in Utah, but did they know each other? They weren't the same age, I can tell you that. But there may be some mysterious connection here.
Yeah. That's very – now, I don't know why not open that up. I mean, heck, who knows where that'll lead?
I'm trying to focus on one, not two, but it's an interesting connection that probably needs to be examined a little more closely.
All right, and we'll do that, too, coming up in the next half hour. You can give us some more time, right, Galen?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay, then here's what I want to do. Coming at the top of the hour, we'll give you the numbers, and I'd love to focus on the photograph, and in particular, as you talk about the suspect's jump wings. And we have a couple of things that are kind of on the table. First of all, we might wonder, without giving away his name again, out of respect to the family and as cooperative as they've been and to the FBI part of the investigation, we might wonder, does this guy look familiar? Did you serve with this guy? Could he have been your ROTC instructor? Were you there at Fort Lewis in Washington in 1971? Is there anything that you could add to this conversation just based on the photograph? And then we'll go back up to the composite drawings as well. And I don't know whether this would be helpful or not, but I've been sort of curious as to what that composite sketch that we have might look like to somebody with the trained eye of a sketch artist.
Very good. Ian, one more thing. Don't forget there's a second piece of evidence up there that I want you to comment on.
Well, and we'll get to that, too, in the next half hour, because I was curious about the whole blood group O and the whole thing and what all of that meant. As you scroll down here, you'll see the photographs, and then you'll see at the bottom, you'll see a little document, which we haven't gotten to yet, but which we will, coming up with Galen Cook. But again, if you happen to be a former police sketch artist, I'm just kind of curious, since we can't yet talk to the woman who gave the police that evidence or gave the police the suggestions for what should go into the composite, knowing what you know about composite sketches versus what photographs actually, you know, look like of the person that the police are looking for, what is it that you think that flight attendant might have been telling the sketch artist? When you see what's up there, what was it she's saying, do you think, if you were a sketch artist, that you end up with that composite? And then how does that play into what we have on the photographs to the right? Go take a look at coasttocoastam.com, and we'll continue this conversation as we hunt down D.B. Cooper live on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett.